Welcome to the Pharma Forum podcast. This is your host, Nicole Rali, and today I have with me Dr. Carl Marcy, Chief Psychiatrist and Managing Director of Mental Health and Neuroscience at Om One. Dr. Marcy is affiliated with Harvard Medical School and Massachusetts General Hospital, and today Carl and I will be discussing his predictions for AI in mental health in the coming year, as well as what might truly make a difference in the field. Indeed, Carl believes the industry needs commitment rather than mere hype when it comes to utilizing and implementing AI in the mental health space. We'll also be looking at how AI in healthcare can make an impact for patients with postpartum depression or PPD and even Alzheimer's disease. Om One was founded on the belief that participating in value-based healthcare requires a much more complete view of patient outcomes than has been available until now. With that principle in mind, the company is focused on transforming healthcare by reimagining how it is measured and delivered. Its real-world data cloud enables different healthcare stakeholders to cost-effectively access, analyze, and use outcomes data in a robust, clinically meaningful, and precise way. But before we dive into the applications of advanced technology in the field of mental health care, perhaps, Carl, you could tell listeners a little bit more about yourself, your journey to today, and doing what you do.
Well, first of all, Nicole, thank you for having me and welcome to your audience. I describe myself as a physician, scientist, and entrepreneur. So as a physician, I'm board certified in adult psychiatry, and I have been treating patients through Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School for the last 20 years, where I have a small clinical practice. And it's a real pleasure and privilege to take care of patients, and I enjoy that. As a scientist, I've published many papers in peer-reviewed journals, always at the interface of healthcare and technology. And really, how do we measure things that to date have been hard to measure, like emotions, engagement, and mental states? And I think this is where AI and data, as we will talk about, is very exciting. And then as an entrepreneur, I fell in love with early stage companies and have been involved in telehealth and telepsychiatry, digital therapeutics, and then more recently with OM1, which, as you mentioned, is a health data and technology company, which I'm looking forward to describing.
Thank you, Carl. So looking at our main theme then, last year, the World Health Organization, or WHO, noted the potential of using artificial intelligence, or AI, in mental health services and research, but that there were yet significant shortcomings that could indicate overly accelerated promotion of new AI models, not yet evaluated as viable in the real world. In 2021, though, over 150 million people in the WHO European region were living with a mental health condition. And over the last few years, the COVID-19 pandemic has, as everyone knows, made matters worse. Now, AI-driven tools can use digitized healthcare data, whether it be electronic health records or EHRs, medical images, or even handwritten clinical notes to automate tasks, support clinicians, and deepen understanding of the causes of complex disorders. Indeed, the benefits of AI in healthcare have been realized, for example, when it comes to the collaboration between AI and clinicians to enhance patient care. So can you tell us more, Carl?
Yeah, so I think there's really two themes there in your question. I think the first one is the technology hype cycle, which has been well-defined, and we've experienced it many times over the last century. The one that your listeners probably may recall is the internet boom of the late 90s, and everything was dot-com this and dot-com that, and then we had a big crash. And it really took another decade or two before we realized the benefits of fully the internet, and I think we still are. I think similarly, AI, particularly with ChatGPT, and some of these generative AI or large language models that are now available at scale, has appropriately generated a lot of excitement, but also a lot of concern. And I think we're really in the early days of that hype cycle. I do not think we've peaked yet. And the one thing we know about hype cycles is they are exactly that. They overpromise and underdeliver. And that's a concern because of the second theme. And that second theme, as you appropriately point out, even before the pandemic, we had a crisis in mental health, and it has gotten much, much worse, right? We're talking about double-digit increases in just about every category of major mental illness, whether it's depression, anxiety, substance use, sadly, suicide. And we need to do better. And I often tell people, if you would have told me in 2001, when I finished my psychiatry residency training, that in 2021, I'd be practicing pretty much the same way, I would have said, that's impossible. We're learning too much about the brain. There's new medications in the pipeline, new technologies. How could that possibly be? Well, I will tell you, Nicole, sadly, I practice largely the same way today than I did when I was training 20 years ago. And that's, you know, that's unfortunate. And that's part of the reason we have a mental health crisis. We just haven't been able to get the tools, technologies, and medications and treatments to the bedside, to patients at scale to have an impact. And in fact, we're going backwards. So that's part of the reason there's so much hype, I think, with AI and mental health. And I'm happy to give you some examples of what we're seeing today, what we're doing at Ohm One, and what I think the future looks like. Is that okay?
Yeah, that'd be great.
I think probably the major application today in mental health is the use of voice to text and then AI tools to organize clinician notes to make clinicians more efficient. And I think we're still in early days there. We, you know, we're aware of many experiments that are going on. I was just reviewing last week a note that was generated by a large language model for a patient with depression. And I sort of rated it a B minus C plus. You know, I think it would be a second year medical student could do an equivalent job. And it was a nice start, but you could see the potential. And I think the potential for just note-taking and organizing notes is twofold. One, the obvious one is efficiency, right? Documentation in psychiatry and mental health just takes time. And time really is money. It also takes clinicians away from delivering care. I think the second one that's often overlooked is better, more comprehensive documentation. One of the things that Ohm One does, I think, incredibly well is we take data from a variety of sources, whether it's through claims data from insurance companies, government data, and importantly, electronic health records from a variety of provider networks. And we bring it in. We are very careful to de-identify it. We use expert raters and the highest security standards available today. And then we organize it in the cloud in what's called a common data architecture. And then the fun begins. And I talk about real world data as having two components, the messy and the missing, right? The messy kind of makes sense because we're getting data from a variety of sources. You can use technology to clean it up. The missing is where AI comes in, and we're able to use artificial intelligence on our data sets to begin to do a number of things. One of them is to train models to help with writing better notes, because as you say, really what scares people, the core of what scares people is what models are trained on. And so having high quality data to train the model should give people some reassurance. Number two, we can then take our models and fill in the missing or places in the patient journey where certain metrics or indicators of health or disease burden are often missing in clinical care in the real world. And by doing that, we now have a more comprehensive data set, and we can bring other tools. For example, Ohm One, we call it Phenome, which is a technology platform that allows us to look at subtypes of depression, for example, who's going to respond to what kind of medications. And over time, as we train those models, we can begin to deliver that information to the bedside to help clinicians make better decisions.
Brilliant. I just want to focus on the data aspect there that you brought up.
Sure.
And how AI is trained on certain models. I mean, AI often involves complex use of statistics, mathematical approaches, and high-dimensional data that could lead to bias or inaccurate interpretation of results and over-optimism, a theme you mentioned earlier, of AI performance if it's not adequately handled. So could you give some more specifics on how that can be circumvented, Carl?
Sure. I mean, I think first of all data is biased to some degree because it comes from humans, and we all have our conscious and unconscious biases. But you can imagine the difference between an early stage company training models for patient care in mental health, for example, on data available on the internet that's publicly available versus data that has been brought in securely. It's been scrubbed. It's been organized. It has external expert review and is done by experts who are really focused on the quality of that data for a particular use case, right? So let me give you an example, right? So at OM1, we have 340 million patients in the cloud in terms of their data. Within mental health, for example, we have millions of patients who have major depressive disorder. When we train our models for depression, we don't train them on all 340 million patients, right? We focus and we don't even train them on all patients with a major depressive disorder diagnosis. We will, for example, use what we call qualifiers, right? You have to have at least two diagnoses 30 days apart. Another qualifier might be you have to have clinical notes of a particular density and complexity. Number three, they have to be relevant. They have to be from a mental health specialist. Number four, they have to be tied to the diagnosis. You can see how it goes on and on from there. So what we'll do is we'll create essentially what we call premium data sets that have been culled, they have expert review, and they get organized and separated. And then we start to train our models. And that starts to make sense, right? We start to realize that we're training models for a particular use case, in this case, subtyping depression. And we're doing it on patients who we know have depression, who have been treated in clinical care by licensed professionals, using documentation that is technically a legal document, right? Electronic health records, people forget, are legal documents, right? They are legal representation of the care you receive under an implied and explicit contract that have all kinds of laws surrounding it. So I really think that the key to good models is good data.
Thank you. So if we talk about the key to this quality of good, it's an ineffective good, perhaps, if it can't be accessed by the patients themselves. So if we focus on this issue of access that you mentioned earlier as well, I mean, the first oral medication was approved for postpartum depression by the FDA, a novel mechanism of action, a neuromodulator, and a fast-acting antidepressant. However, there remain challenges for getting treatment to those in need. In terms of awareness, access, and affordability, what does the coming year, just the coming year, look like? And how can AI help in that regard?
Yeah, I think step one is we need to collect data that's relevant to that population, right? And there's two ways to do that. We can look at our archive data, and we've done this, and identify patients who have been diagnosed with depression within 3 or 6 months of a pregnancy, and we can look at their journeys, and we can look at their outcomes. And that begins to create a data set, like I was referring to earlier, that you can begin to train on. Step two is we're going to need data specific to, in this case, zuranolone, which is the oral medication that came to market. Very exciting. As you say, novel mechanism, appears to have a rapid response in women. The 1 in 10 or 1 in 5 women who get either postpartum blues or sometimes, tragically, a much more severe version of depression following the delivery of a child. And in that case, I think the challenge is really behavioral change and changing standards of clinical care, right? Who is there at the beginning of what's now called the fourth trimester, right? You know, mom delivers a baby, hopefully everybody's healthy, there's a lot of joy, and all the focus shifts from mommy and her belly and the baby to this newborn baby and making sure that child is appropriately cared for. And mom falls through the cracks. Right. So one way that we're thinking about this is to develop tools to identify mothers who are most at risk and be able to flag them even before they've delivered that child so that the monitoring and the screening and the system is ready to do the appropriate interventions, both in terms of diagnostics, but also in terms of delivering the medication. I mean, in terms of the economics of that, you know, that's a little hard for me to say AI is going to have an impact on that right away. But you can imagine a world, as you mentioned in your introduction, where we finally get to the promise of value-based care. And value-based care is very simply, you know, preventive measures, early intervention, taking care of patients in the most efficient way possible, to create incentives to do that, we're going to need tools to identify patients at the earliest stage of illness in order to have those interventions. So I do think in time, there will be economic benefits.
Thank you. So if we think about just the sheer potential of this technology, and we stick with these notions of, well, not notions, these needs of awareness, accessibility, and affordability, this similarly arises as a questionnaire for Alzheimer's, doesn't it? I mean, there are new treatment developments and hope within research. I mean, Viagra was most recently a case in point. So if we sort of shift our thinking for a second, Carl, to the Alzheimer's research space, what's the applicability there for AI, perhaps?
Yeah, I think the parallels to postpartum depression are twofold. One, you've got a class of medication with a novel mechanism, in this case, amyloid-targeted therapies, that are disease modifying. And what does that mean? So to date in Alzheimer's, most of the medications, in fact, all the medications have really been trying to treat symptoms. And they haven't been able to get to the core of the illness. In this case, we have these amyloid plaques, which are believed to be a core part of the pathology of Alzheimer's, and a targeted therapy designed to stimulate the body's own immune system to make these plaques dissolve or shrink. And what we know now from clinical trials is that's beginning to have an impact. What's exciting, I think, and we should all be excited about, is for the first time in Alzheimer's, we have a correlation between the disease pathology, in this case, amyloid plaques, and a treatment that shrinks it, and then a clinical outcome, patients decline. It still continues, but it's slower. And so you can extend the quality of life for patients, you know, sometimes 3 months, we're hoping 6 months, and over time, even longer. Now, the key here, unlike postpartum depression, where you know the event is, you know, mom has baby, here, early intervention is going to be key. Because we know from all the clinical trials is that mild cognitive impairment, which is even pre-dementia or early dementia, is really when these medications work best. Well, our system isn't really designed to capture people that early because to date, we really haven't had very effective treatments. So there isn't a whole mechanism of screening people as they enter their late 40s, 50s, and 60s for dementia. And I think that's what needs to shift. Now, where AI comes in is the ability, once again, to tag people at higher risk. And certainly you can do that the traditional way through family history and epidemiological studies. What we're doing at OM1 is we're using this platform. Again, we call it Phenome, where we're able to take large amounts of patients who are already in the cloud. We're looking backwards in time. We're taking their first diagnosis of, in this case, Alzheimer's, and then going further back in time and saying, what is their digital footprint? What does their digital phenotype look like? And that's where the name Phenome comes in. And what are the signatures or patterns or fingerprints that we can identify and then apply that tool to a new population in a prospective way and say, hey, you look a lot like people who go on to have mild cognitive impairment. We're going to watch you a little closer. And I think that's really an exciting use of the technology.
Exciting indeed. So if we look further into the future now, not just the year ahead, but longer term, say 5 years, say a decade. What's that look like, that landscape, Carl?
Yeah, I think we continue to build on the momentum in the areas I've discussed. So the tools that help clinicians document more efficiently and more comprehensively should evolve and get better. I think we'll also have better quality controls in place. I mean, right now, as you probably know, there are quality review committees in every hospital and every clinic that review charts. Well, what does that look like in a world where, you know, a computer is helping write them? How do we even begin to think about that? So I think we'll get better at that. And then I think there'll be new areas of applications of AI. Another area that I'm excited about not only is the idea of bedside decision support. And it's important for your audience to know we're not going to replace clinicians anytime soon. We really want to make them more efficient. So the idea that Mrs. Jones comes in to see me and I put her some simple demographic and maybe a couple of clinical facts into a computer model, and then I get a report back instantly that says Mrs. Jones is more likely to respond to this type of medication for her type of depression. I think we're going to begin to see that. And then I think finally, we're going to begin to see and unlock the potential of the supercomputer that all of us have in our pockets, right? So the idea that, you know, I see a patient at most every 2 weeks, more frequently ever 10, 12 weeks, it's a lot of time in between there. If we can begin to tap into the sensing platform that we all have with us, an arm's reach away, and use our AI tools in a secure way that's in service of patients and not in service of big companies, I think we can start to really understand mental illness at a more granular level and really start to evolve and improve not only the type of digital fingerprinting we're doing today, but imagine a world where we now have continuous streams of data, you know, 24/7, what the computers can do with that. I think that's even more exciting.
That is exciting. And that goes towards the wearables sector, doesn't it?
100%. Yeah. And now you have the supercomputer that's connected to wearables. You're getting even richer biometric and other data. I really think, like most fields today, progress is made through multiple disciplines combining and looking at the problem. In this case, we're going to combine wearable sensing and some biological signatures that come with that, whether it's heart rate or skin conductivity or accelerometers. We're going to have self-report. Patients are always going to tell us things about themselves. And then we're going to have phenotyping across the digital outputs from all of these devices and sources that are going to begin to create a more comprehensive view of mental illness and will finally make the progress we so desperately need.
Absolutely. And with that momentum, as you said earlier, get to the promise of value-based care with the right tools, with the right data, at the right time. Thank you very much, Carl. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you.
And so that concludes another episode of the Pharma Forum podcast. You can find out more information about this episode, including a download link and information about previous installments of the series at pharmaforum.com/podcasts. The Pharma Forum podcast is also available on iTunes, Spotify, Acast, Stitcher, and Podbean, where you can find and subscribe by searching for Pharma Forum. Of course, don't forget to visit our website itself, where you can sign up for daily news and analysis bulletins, and follow us on Twitter, or X nowadays, at Pharma Forum. That's all for now. Thank you for listening.